Thank you, Ira. I didn't cut you off there. Don't know what happened there. Thank you, Ira. Welcome to Wednesday's programme. Are you well? Are you in good form? Wasn't that handy now, wasn't it? Wasn't that handy and coincidental? An ISIS suicide attack on a town in Syria that killed US soldiers at a time when the US president declared that he had intended to pull US troops out of Syria. What an amazing coincidence, eh?
Welcome back to the most listened to independent radio show in Europe. It's your Richie Allen Show.
Yes, Donald Trump appeases bewildered and beleaguered supporters by saying, I'm going to keep one of my campaign promises. I'm going to leave Syria. Of course, he had no intention of doing that. And then along comes the justification for saying, well, I've got to flip-flop on that one. Yeah. This is the Richie Allen Show. Welcome.
It's the Richie Allen Show. Broadcasting live on richieallen.co.uk and multiple platforms around the world. And now, here's your host, Richie Allen.
I'll be joined live from New York City by the one and only Gerald Celente, the legendary publisher of the Trends Journal. Top man. He really is. I have a lot of time for Gerald. Trendsresearch.com is the website. Support the Trends Journal. We'll talk about, well, the forthcoming year. I'm sure we'll talk about Trump and Syria. Lots to get into with Gerald this hour. He joins me in about 15, 20 minutes' time. And in the second hour, David Sedgwick joins the programme. He's not been on before. He's an academic and author, and his latest book is called BBC Brainwashing Britain. Very interesting book. He takes the reader on a disturbing journey deep into the realms of mistruth and deception to reveal the tricks and subterfuges used by the BBC. David Sedgwick, can't wait to speak to David. He joins the programme in the second hour. Packed old show on Wednesday. We're live on Fab Radio 2 in Manchester, triggerwarning.tv, richieallen.co.uk, and tune in radio. If you'd like to join in, you need only tweet me at the regular Twitter handle. There you are. Don't need to keep telling you. At Richie Allen Show on Twitter. Yeah. Handy that, isn't it? Suicide bombers in Syria. Yeah. What is the BBC saying about it? Just briefly, because I'll get into this with Gerald. The BBC is reporting that a number of US troops and civilians have been killed by a suicide bomb in Syria, in a town which is currently held by Kurdish forces. It's Manbij is the town. It's in the northwest, is it? Is that where it is? This particular town. IS, or Islamic State, claimed that its militants detonated an explosive vest next to a US patrol. 3 US soldiers, 2 local security officers, 13 civilians have died. Handy that. Not handy for the people killed, of course. I take no... there's no mirth, nothing to laugh at there. But the timing is wonderful, of course, as it so often is. I'm sure you'll have a lot to say about that. It's Richie Allen Show on Twitter. Now, I don't read listener comments, not because I'm arrogant and not because I don't care. It's because I'm too experienced for that. I've been around a long time. It's a time-wasting exercise reading listeners' comments. It really is. I do read the tweets that come in during the live show because I'm interested in reading them out. But YouTube comments, Facebook, I left Facebook a year ago nearly. The comments on the podcast, I don't read them. Now, a friend of mine is looking after the YouTube channel for me, keeping an eye on it. I upload to the channel, but he acts as a kind of an admin for it. He's been trying in vain to get the videos monetized for months, even though I have told him it will never happen. Stop wasting your time, Rog. It's going nowhere. Anyway, Google YouTube says no, 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 no. Please reapply next month. No, my video's never going to be monetized. No problem, I don't care. Left all that behind when they deleted the original channel last year. Anyway, Rog, excuse me, was reading the comments left by listeners to the YouTube edit of yesterday's show, and he sent me a selection of them to read out, saying to me, the comments are a brilliant illustration of a point that has been made on this show repeatedly by myself. You know, all right. So I said I'll read the comments anyway. What is the point that I have made repeatedly? Well, it's about how social media users and people who live online, how it has made people increasingly narcissistic and incapable of tolerance for ideas or for opinions they don't agree with or they don't like. So let me read a few of these comments, give you an example of what I'm talking about. Jim Fetzer is being sued, along with his co-author, for the book Nobody Died at Sandy Hook. And he's being sued by Lenny Posner, father of Noah, who was one of the named victims of the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting of December 2012. Now, Jim came on to talk about the lawsuit, and we spoke for around 35 minutes. I've known Jim a long time. I like Jim a lot. A lot of time for him, as I, you know, said last night before getting him on. Here's a flavour of the comments. Most posts, not all, but most posted by faceless and nameless YouTube users with rather immature usernames. Here we go. Some of them are long, so I've edited them without taking anything away from the context. I haven't selectively edited them. I've just scaled a couple of them down. Here's one from Andy Fowlds. Andy Fowlds. Richie, do your research, mate. How can you possibly believe any of these characters involved in Sandy Hook are genuine? Do yourself a favour, Richie. Don't discuss this subject with expert analysts such as Jim Fetzer or Wolfgang Halbig if all you want to do is play the devil's advocate and criticise their efforts to expose the monumental hoax this event was. And you also said there was no evidence to suggest the Hampstead satanic ritual abuse case was real. Did you do any research in this case? That's from Andy Fowlds. Come back to that. John Richardson. Richie is so pathetically cowardly and befuddled on this issue, as on the fake Holocaust, about which there are masses of evidence that it never happened. It's embarrassing to hear Richie wriggling and repetitively flapping about in defence of obvious lies. Hearing Richie try to argue against Professor Fetzer is like listening to a 6-year-old arguing against the Nobel Prize winner. Right. Somebody calling themselves Shiner3 Lima. Yeah. Posted on YouTube, casting doubt on Mr. Fetzer is a disgraceful act by Richie. Disgrace, Richie. Then somebody called Demon of the North tweeted, idiots in comments smearing Richie for not coming to conclusions on Sandy Hook. Fools do not understand what real journalism is. Robert Somerville posted, so disappointed that your objectivity has been compromised by your emotions, Richie. Man up, for goodness sakes. Morris Adams tweets, I love you, Richie. Thanks, Morris. But this is textbook definition of cognitive dissonance. He points to evidence after evidence and you follow with yeah, buts and what ifs. It didn't fucking happen, says Morris. Peter Riley says Richie knows the truth, he just can't say. Yeah, Richie's a coward. He knows the truth, but he just can't say what it is. Jerry M posted on YouTube, Fetzer has zero proof of anything. Everything he offers as proof is either doctored documents or photoshopped photos. He has no evidence that Lenny Posner is fictitious, and he has recently admitted that Noah Posner's death certificate is indeed a valid certificate of death. Fetzer is as insane as Alex Jones. And when it comes down to it, Fetzer's fabricated so-called evidence and his slanderous abuse of the parents of these 20 children, who were murdered, is just making a buck off of and making a living off of the pain and suffering of parents and dead children. Jerry M. Moody Moods. I know you're trying to protect your channel, Richie, but how much proof do you require? I personally think this subject should not have been brought up because of past experiences, but thanks anyway. Thank you, Moody Moods. Mr. Everyman 9. Richie is merely being the devil's advocate and asking if there could have been one or two genuine deaths. At the same time, he doesn't jeopardise this wonderful programme. Yippee, says Mr. Everyman 9. Robert Burke says, hope the parents of these dead children take this asshole, Alex Jones, and other Sandy Hook denier cults for everything they have. MC Dirty Work says, we're nearly at the end of them. I'm surprised at you, Richie, throwing Jim Fetzer under the bus like that at the very beginning of the programme, saying you genuinely believe that he believes what he believes, like he's some sort of nut. No, MC Dirty Work, with your pathetic username. Of course I wasn't suggesting that because Jim believes what he believes, he's a nut. I was suggesting by saying that Jim believes what he says means to me that he's not out to hurt anybody. He's not out to cause anybody any emotional harm. It's the point I was making. Somebody calling themselves Wisdom Game TV, yeah, posted, tonight at home, Richie's girl friend might ask, please, Richie, when or when are you going to grow a pair? Well, that's piss poor grammar and spelling right there, Mr. Wisdom Game TV. Look up quotation marks. Girl friend. Girlfriend is one word, by the way. There is a book called Grammar for Dummies. Get it. As for protecting the YouTube channel is worthless to me. It's a pain in the arse. The programme is a live radio programme. It's archived on Podomatic, Spotify and iTunes. There's nothing to be gained in keeping the YouTube channel going, except for some users asked me to post the show on YouTube because it suits them better. It's the only reason. I couldn't give a damn if the YouTube channel is deleted. My interview with Jim Fetzer was conducted in the same manner as my interviews with Wolfgang Halbig. Skeptical, asking questions, putting the other side of it across in the absence of the other side of it. Devil's advocacy, or whatever you want to call it, that's about the size of it. Not worried about the channel. What's wrong with people? What's happening to people that they can't exist in a world where other people have opposing points of view to them? Why can't people live with others who see things differently than they do? In the case of this programme, it's kind of bizarre, because this programme, with an enormous audience as far as the independent media goes, it's minuscule compared to commercial media, but in the independent media, in the UK and in Europe, there isn't anything with a bigger reach than this. Wouldn't you think they'd be happy that we would be bringing people like Jim on, getting him to talk about the lawsuit, giving him all the time in the world, but asking him questions, the sorts of questions he would be asked in days of yore when we used to have a media? You would think that would be okay, but no. If you ask questions, if you throw some doubt or some, I don't know, if you throw some other points of view into the mix, into the ring, you, as the host or as the producer, must be some sort of government-controlled shill. It's ridiculous, isn't it? But sadly, it's not the exception anymore. It's becoming the rule. Of course, what I was doing with Jim last night was putting some other, not completely implausible, hypotheses to Jim. Saying, well, you're not 100% right. Maybe you're not 100% right. Maybe these people are genuine. What if they are? Isn't it a terrible thing? And it isn't incompatible, the notion that something very wrong happened in Sandy Hook, a FEMA drill, a false flag event of some sort, that isn't incompatible with a few real people dying and real families being subjected to that. I didn't say that I believe that. It's my job to put those points of view out there. And yet we're beset on all sides by people who lose their collective shit when their worldview is challenged or threatened in any way. It's madness. As for the Hampstead Heath satanic ritual abuse hoax, which is what it was, I interviewed Sabine McNeil, as some of you know, once about that on the programme. Again, I retained healthy scepticism about it. Not for a minute have I ever said that satanic ritual abuse hasn't happened. I think the false memory syndrome theories are nonsense. I do believe it has happened, and I suggest if anybody wants to get to grips with satanic ritual abuse, the man who has written most about it in recent years and with most credibility is a guy called David Icke. A bunch of cowboys pretending to be journalists on the south coast of this country are not in any way authorities on satanic ritual abuse. Hampstead Heath was the greatest joke hoax ever perpetrated on the people of the United Kingdom. And I believe it was enabled to a degree by an ex-Navy guy pretending to be a journalist, spending a lot of time with the hoaxers themselves, the parents of the children, in order to further his own position, to cover himself in glory as some sort of champion of the abused and some sort of crusader against child abuse. Hampstead was engineered by a woman and her partner as part of a years-old custody dispute. The children were coached to make those claims. These claims that their dad was part of a cult that ate babies and made shoes out of baby skin and killed babies that were shipped in, and the babies' throats were cut and everybody would drink the blood, and everybody was involved in this. Everybody, teachers, principals, the church, loads of neighbours, friends, social workers were all involved in it. At McDonald's, the babies were cooked and everybody ate the babies out of the ovens. Nonsense. The mother had a history of making bizarre allegations against the children's father, dating back years before the videos. And those who promoted this hoax, the greatest, the cowboys on the south coast, knew that the mother had been making claims against the father for years. The kids repeated what they'd been coached to say, as horrifying as it was to watch. Later on, the kids said the mother's boyfriend had beaten them, had poured cold water over them in their underwear, hammered them, and asked them questions again and again and again and again. People will say forever, how could the kids say all of that? The detail, how could they remember it? As a child, I was a reluctant treader of the boards. In primary school, can't sing a note now, couldn't sing a note when I was a child, but nobody would do anything, and I didn't care. I never minded standing up. I was in the Mikado. I played Nanky Poo. I was in Oklahoma. I was in Jesus Christ Superstar. I was 7 years old, and I could learn pages and pages and pages of dialogue. Not just my own dialogue and my own songs, but also the songs and the dialogue of other cast members. Of course, the children learned their lines. Sabine McNeil is in jail. I have nothing but sympathy for Sabine McNeil, because she genuinely believed it. But she went after people in that town, despite being told not to, again and again and again. Should she be in jail? No. No. Not for a minute. I wouldn't put her in jail. But she got it wrong. But the people who helped perpetrate this, I should say perpetuated for the time period it was perpetuated, the Mickey Mouse no marks on the south coast, including the former Navy man. Wonder why the police never knocked on his door. I wonder. Well, people are going to jail. And it's the sort of cognitive dissonance that we see in the Truth or Industrial Complex. The fans of these people, so desperate for things to be true that they lose all ability to think critically and to look at it and go, well, yeah, maybe, I'm not sure about it now. And the Truth or Industrial Complex, of course, preys on this and thrives on it. That people want to be told what it is they believe. They want it repeated back to them, time and again, repeated back to them. To give them a sense of security, I don't know. To give them a sense of worthiness, I don't know. But all they do, truthers, is sell back to people that which people already believe. Whether it's true or not, it doesn't matter. That's why I introduced the Hampstead thing. And I said Jim Fetzer is not responsible for the morons that have threatened to kill some of the residents of the area, Sandy Hook Elementary School, Connecticut. He's right to ask questions. He's got some brilliant questions about Sandy Hook. I think the whole thing is an absolute mess. I don't believe the official story. But I don't know that people didn't die there. I don't know that Lenny Posner is lying. So it's my job to put that to Jim Fetzer. You know, people need to wake up. Stop saying wake up. It's a cliche. Stop saying wake up unless you really want to wake up. Unless you really want to wake up and have the courage of self-criticism and self-analysis. Why am I believing everything I'm told by these people? Why do I want this stuff to be true? Is there any truth in it? Where's the evidence? This is the Richie Allen Show. It's 24 minutes past the hour. Going to take some music. When we come back, I'll be joined by none other than Gerald Celente, live from New York City. Alrighty. I know I went off on a few different tangents there. I didn't script any of that. 25 minutes past the hour. Michael Jackson on the Richie Allen Show, The Way You Make Me Feel. January 16th, 2019. It's Wednesday's programme. Don't forget later on, David Sedgwick and his explosive book about the BBC. David Sedgwick in the second hour. Now, it's an absolute pleasure to welcome back to the programme for the first time in 2019. A man I got to know many years ago in during my time in Spain. I call him what he is, a legendary trends researcher and the publisher of the brilliant Trends Journal. I get the journal sent to me. I get a courtesy copy of it, complimentary copy sent to me every quarter, which is fantastic. If I didn't, I would subscribe to it, so maybe they might cancel my complimentary copy now. And I don't endorse very much, as you know. He's been accurately predicting economic and political trends for many, many years. 2018 was another big year for him. I'm sure you're interested to hear what he thinks about the forthcoming year. Let's welcome back to the programme, live from New York City, our friend Gerald Celente. Gerald, welcome back.
Ah, great being on. I miss being on with you. It's been a while.
It has. I think it was towards the end of last summer you were on. But in the meantime, I wasn't well. I had about a month off and it was all over the place. But no, I'd have you on every month if you'd come on every month. But you get a million requests to do these interviews. It's a bit late to be saying Happy New Year, but Happy New Year to you. Congratulations on another massive year in 2018 with the Trends Journal. 2019 is going to be absolutely nuts, Gerald. I was asked to put to you a breaking story about a suicide attack in Syria that Islamic State has claimed responsibility for. It's killed three US servicemen. It's also killed civilians there and security officers. I was asked to put to you how timely or how coincidental you might feel that is right now at a time when the US president has been talking about taking US troops out of Syria. What do you think of that?
Well, number one, the United States has no right being there. We're there illegitimately. We have no right being there. Period. Paragraph. And yes, I would suggest that every time it looks as though either the Syrian government is winning and all of a sudden there's that white helmet coming out saying that there was a chemical attack and then the United States sending missiles in response to that. Or in this aspect that Trump wants to pull out of Syria and he's getting blowback that ISIS is still alive and we have to stop them. Now, I want to make this 100% clear. The United States involvement in Syria had nothing to do with ISIS. As a matter of fact, by the way, just to make this clear, this whole ISIS thing is an attack against Italians. And me being one, I know how it hurts because how are we going to sell Italian ices? Nobody's going to buy them. Anyway, the reason that the United States was there, and all anybody listening has to do is Google up, Assad has to go, Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, and John Kerry. That was the excuse that these murderers gave for United States involvement in Syria. Assad has to go. ISIS? Oh, do you mean those rebel groups that the United States and its coalition of the killing, including the Arab Little League, put together? Is that the ISIS that you're talking about? Are those the rebels with a cause that you're talking about? How about this one, Richie? 2 days ago, Israel Army Chief admits to arming Syrian rebels. It was the first confirmation from the Army Chief, Israeli Army Chief of Staff Gadi Eisenkopf, confirmed that the Israeli military provided weapons to Syrian rebels. It was the first confirmation, but back in September, Israeli media were reporting that Israel had armed as many as 12 rebel factions. And the rebel factions have been confirming such support for a while, as saying they were given large amounts of money and aid from Israel as well. Syria confirmed it, capturing arms and munitions with Hebrew writing on them held by the rebels. Israel claims of neutrality were, oh, again, you know. So to answer your question about this, how about this one? In policy shift, Netanyahu confirms Israel attacks on Iranian sites in Syria. Quote, we worked with impressive success to block Iran's military entrenchment in Syria, Mr. Netanyahu said at the start of a meeting. He said, quote, just in the last 36 hours, the Air Force attacked Iranian warehouses with Iranian weapons at the international airport in Damascus. Quote, the accumulation of recent attacks proves that we are determined more than ever to take action against Iran in Syria.
That's a big trend this year, isn't it? That region and Iran and the plans that the neocon Zionist cabal have for Iran. I've been talking about this with your great friend and colleague, Paul Craig Roberts. Do you think all roads lead to Iran this year, Gerald?
Yes. And it was, matter of fact, it was one of our top trends for 2018. We wrote about it in the beginning of the year, and it was for 28. We wrote about it in 2017 for 2018. And the top trend was, one of the top trends was market shock, mass murder. And what we said was that the United States, Saudi Arabia, and Israel were forming an alliance to take out Iran. And then we saw that just came out, and we were right on target. The White House sought options to strike Iran's state, Pentagon officials said. Quote, this isn't ancient history. Today, this is 3 days ago. President Trump's National Security Council asked the Pentagon to provide the White House with military options to strike Iran last year.
Yeah.
It came after, ready for this? This is the way they write it. It came after militants fired three more. Who are the militants? Who are these militants?
Who are these militants? Yeah.
Yeah. All right. It came after militants fired three mortars into Baghdad, sprawling diplomatic quarter, home of the U.S. Embassy, on a warm night in early September. This is from the Wall Street Journal. The shells launched by the group aligned with Iran. How did they know this group was aligned with Iran? Landed in an open lot and harmed no one. The Pentagon complied with the National Security Council request to develop options for striking Iran, the officials said. They triggered an unusual alarm in Washington when Mr. Trump's national security team, led by John Bolton, conducted a series of meetings to discuss a forceful American response, including what many saw as the request for options to strike Iran. John Bolton, a sick SOB. And then we heard, you know, it's one after another. The facts are coming out here. Pompeo, however you pronounce this guy's name, was in Cairo last week. And here's his quote. "We will not ease our campaign to stop Iran's malevolent influence and actions against this region and the world." He also vowed that the U.S. economic sanctions on Iran, quote, "will keep getting tougher until Iran starts behaving like a normal country." The normal country he's in, by the way, is Egypt, where there was a military coup that overthrew the democratically elected government. And the other, of course, country that is normal to him is Saudi Arabia. You know,
with its human rights record.
That's another normal country, yeah, along with the other Arab League countries.
The Saudis. You know, I think I said this to you some years ago. A friend of mine was in Riyadh on business years and years ago and came across some guy being, this is genuine, came across some guy being beheaded. He followed a crowd of people, thought he was going to a soccer match. Guy was beheaded. It turned out the guy was suspected of running drugs, and it wasn't kilos of drugs either. And his head was lopped off. My friend never got over it. He was in therapy for years. To call that a normal country, eh?
Yeah, again, and now they're on this crown prince, and you know how he became a crown prince.
Yeah.
A princess kissed the frog, and the frog became a prince. This is a gang. It's a gang that was created in 1934. Anyway, he is now, they're looking at more beheadings this year than at any other time. And Pompeo, this is the headline. In Tuesday's, this is January 15th, yesterday's New York Wall Street Journal, Pompeo affirms U.S.-Saudi ties. The Saudis are friends. Yeah, friends. Not my friends, Jack.
And we're sending them billions of pounds worth of weapons in this country.
Yep. It started with Obama, by the way, when they launched the war against Yemen. And, of course, it's the greatest humanitarian crisis right now in the world. Over 60,000 people slaughtered, and it doesn't make the news at all. Except the big news was when they killed that reporter, that Khashoggi guy. That was big news. But slaughter innocent Yemenis every day, Yemenis, that's okay. And the UK, the United States, Canada, and others supplying with the weapons to kill these innocent people. So if your country is doing it, and you support it, you are an accessory to murder, just like you would be an accessory to murder if a sick SOB, other than Pompeo or Bolton or Theresa May or Trump or Obama or any of the others, asked you for money to commit murder against innocent people, an illegal crime, you would be an accomplice
an
to
accessory,
murder.
An accessory, wouldn't you? You'd be an accessory before the fact because you know what the weaponry is going to be used to do. You know, if you hated the guy living next door to you, Gerald, and you really hated him, and I gave you a loaded gun, I know there's a very good chance you're going to shoot him with it. Therefore, you're an accessory before the fact. It's interesting that you talk about Yemen. Look at the coverage that Sky News in London gave to the attack in the hotel in Nairobi in Kenya yesterday. And they talked about Al-Shabaab militants, these Islamic militants, and it got an awful lot of coverage. Even with all the Brexit stuff, it got a lot of coverage. And you make a brilliant point. Not a word these days about Yemen. In our media, not a word. Nothing. How tragic.
So that's our, to answer to the question, yes, it is suspect. And number two, we have no right being there. You're invading a country, a sovereign nation that did nothing to you But we had that arrogant Obama, and only if the women were in charge, Hillary Clinton, Samantha Power, and Susan Rice, Assad has to go. We don't like the way he's treating his people, I tells you.
Yeah.
What a bunch of crap.
Let me ask you this. Folks, if you've just joined us, Gerald Celente, the irrepressible Gerald Celente, live on the line from New York, trendsresearch.com. When I say I don't endorse much, I don't endorse anything. Subscribe to the Trends Journal. Subscribe to it. He's absolutely, as we say, bang on the money, year in, year out, with these trends, geopolitical and economic trend forecasts. It's terrific stuff, it really is. Gerald and his team are amazing. Check it out. Question I want to ask you, I've been asked to put it to you, and it's about the failure of the UK government to implement the result of the referendum 2.5 years ago, where people voted to leave the European Union. It's looking like Brexit is not going to happen. I was asked to put this to you. Do you forecast, or can you see, that this will lead to a rise of the so-called right? It will lead to a rise of nationalism and populism around Europe, because I should say England as much as Europe, because the journalists in the disgraceful media here in the UK are warning people and terrifying people with stories of a massive rise of the right if we don't stay in the European Union, a massive rise on the right if we don't actually leave. It's incredible. They want to have their cake and eat it. What do you think about the rise of the right, fascism and populism and all of that in 2019?
Well, it's going to continue. But, you know, just on the note on Brexit, now, correct me if I'm wrong, that back in March 29th, 2017, the UK delivered a notification to the EU that under Article 50 of the EU's Lisbon Treaty, that they were going to leave on March 29th, 2019.
Yes.
They had to give it. So with or without the deal, they're supposed to be leaving.
We should be gone at 11 o'clock, 11 p.m. on March 29th, which is only a couple of months away. Yeah, we're supposed to be gone, deal or no deal.
Exactly. Now, to answer your question, everybody listening, get this in your head. Your vote doesn't count. Your country is being run by dictatorships that morons and jerks call political parties. Look what happened in Greece when the Greek people voted against the IMF sanctions that the government wanted to put them on.
Yeah.
That little jerk over there, Tsipras?
Alexis Tsipras, spot on, Gerald, yeah. That's right.
Said to the people, F you. What the hell do we care what you want? Don't you know who I am? I'm the little flunky for the bankster boys. I'm the little wanker. I got to be proper. I can't say jerk off like we say in the United States.
No, this is good. Wanker is good.
I'm going to do what I'm told to do. Your vote doesn't count, and neither do the people in the United Kingdom. Your vote means nothing. All you are, get this in your head, everybody, are workers on the globalized multinational plantation of Slavelandia. What this is all about, the guy Paolo Savona, I remember his name.
In Italy.
He was going to be the choice when Lega and Cinque Stelle in Italy formed the coalition, that he was going to be the economics minister.
That's right.
And Conte, the guy that was the prime minister, killed the deal. Paolo Savona said, this cat's 81 years old, all we are in the European Union are nothing more than colonies of Germany. And that's all it was. What do you think the Greek bailout was for? It was to bail out the banksters that made out the bad deals in Germany. Why do you think Germany was the one that kept pushing the European Union and has the euro? Because if they had the Deutschmark, they wouldn't be able to export their product because the Deutschmark would be so valuable, people wouldn't be able to afford them. But now they have the euro, and now they could sell more of their product. All the eurozone is nothing more than a colony of Germany. I agree 100% with Paolo Savona.
Brilliant. And as you said, and you've written about this, the Brussels said, no, we're not going to have him. And the coalition collapsed. Why did they do that? Why didn't they say, you're not going to tell us who the finance minister is going to be? Do we have to worry about... You see, again, you brilliantly brought up the Syriza party in Greece. Now, I'm not a trends forecaster. And most of what I predict doesn't come true. That's a fact. I make guesses. I don't have your skills and your experience. The only thing I've ever gotten right, Gerald, was the Tsipras thing. When Syriza won, I said, and it's the only thing I've ever gotten right, this party is not going to deliver Greece from the clutches of the financial institutions of Germany, as you brilliantly said there. I knew that wouldn't happen. Should we be worried about these coalitions that come along seemingly on the side of the people, and then so often they turn out not to be really on the side of the people? What do you think?
Yes, we should be concerned. And by the way, you asked me the question also, are we going to see more anti-establishment movements? Yes. Not in the United States, by the way. The people still, we just had a midterm election. In the entire midterm election, not one of the candidates from either of the dictatorship parties mentioned anything about America's wars overseas and the $715 billion, soon to be $750 billion defense budget. Not one peep about the illegal, immoral, trillion-dollar, multi-trillion-dollar wars killing millions of people.
Yeah.
So nothing's going to happen here because, people that lost their fight. This is the Me Too country here. Did you see, by the way, that Gillette thing?
Oh, my God. Yeah, I did, yeah. What's going on there?
Well, I'm about male toxicity.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to one-up Gillette. I demand that the name of the place where pilots sit to pilot airplanes should no longer be called a cockpit.
Lest it offend.
I think it's disgusting calling this a cockpit. And I just came back, by the way, I was in the UK with my friend Kenny Young, who wrote Under the Boardwalk.
Marvelous.
And we went to Nepal to visit an old friend. And back in November, December, I just got back recently. Anyway, I also decided they should change the names in the mountains over there. They shouldn't call it Himalaya. This is disgusting. So anyway, going on to the United States and our identity politics and no big issues. No, we're not going to see anti-establishment movements here, but we're seeing them in France with the yellow vest. We saw it in Italy with the five-star movement, and they backtracked. And Lega, they backtracked on their promise to have a bigger deficit and give the people more money. And look what's going on now with the yellow vest. They're arresting people.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And they're clamping down on it. And you're going to see that in every country. The establishment, along with these so-called police who are nothing more than thugs that are little boys and girls for the powers above them, are going to put down every protest with the most amount of violence that threatens the establishment. Because, again, I may get censored for this too. We just got through the Christmas season. Christmas used to be celebrated for the birth of a guy. I may get in trouble for saying this, for the birth of Jesus Christ. It wasn't about Black Friday or retail sales.
Yeah.
The Prince of Peace becomes violent when he picks up a whip to drive the money changers out of the temple. Nothing has changed, Richie Allen, since the birth of Christ and the death of Jesus, fighting the money changers. The money changers are controlling the world. $26 trillion central banksters pumped up to pump up the markets. And they're doing it again. We just heard the Fed chair over here, Jerome Powell, backtracking on his BS in September that they were going to raise interest rates three or four more times in the United States in 2019. So on January 4th, 2019, when we got sky-high numbers for employment and the highest number of wage increases over throughout a year in the last 10 years, rather than using that as an excuse to raise interest rates, he said, because of the volatility in the equity markets, we're going to be patient. And now you're seeing the equity markets come back. Because what being patient means is giving another shot and many more shots of monetary methadone into the financial junkies' bull to keep it running.
Just before we run out of time, because it's approaching lunchtime for you there, and I know you have a packed schedule this Wednesday afternoon. Patricia's listening to this in Zurich in Switzerland, and she was born in the States. She believes that the United States government under Trump has dropped more bombs than his predecessor Obama. I think that's true. I don't want to put you on the spot, but can you confirm that?
He dropped more bombs in Afghanistan than Obama. Obama killed over 4,000 innocent people with drone strikes, and quoted in the book, Double Down, I'm really good at killing people. Obama also did away with our habeas corpus rights in the United States that allows the government to kill any of us anywhere in the world, whether it's in the United States or abroad, without any judge, jury, or trial. Obama launched the Libyan war that destroyed the richest country in Africa and turned it into shambles. Obama launched the Syrian war with the Saudis and the Arab Little League and the other murderers. Yes, Trump has done that, but I am totally against Trump's Iran policy, pulling out of Iran. I'm totally opposed to Trump, but of course it's called payoff. He got $23 million in estimated from that guy who owns all those, Sheldon Adelson, who owns all those casinos, and pulling the embassy out of Tel Aviv and moving it to Jerusalem. But I am totally supportive of Trump for wanting to end the Syrian war and the Afghanistan war and bring the troops home, because I also launched Occupy Peace, www.occupypeace.com. I put hundreds of thousands of dollars of my money into where my heart is for a peace movement. So yes, Trump has dropped more bombs in Afghanistan than Obama did in a year. But Obama has wars throughout his entire presidency. The only president with wars throughout 8 years in the office.
And I'll never forget, as long as I live, the optimism back in 2008 when Obama, the first black president, took the oath of office. I'll never forget it. And even then I knew enough to know that nothing would change. But the optimism is incredible. Absolutely final question. I've tweeted a link to OccupyPeace.com. It's a brilliant initiative, Gerald. It really is. And the very best of luck with it going forward this year. This isn't a quick one, so I'm a bit cheeky asking you this because it might take a couple of minutes. Listeners are asking me about a crash in 2019. a financial crash.
We thought it would happen. We thought it would happen. But again, the reason we said it would happen is because the Federal Reserve said they would raise interest rates one more time in 2018, which they did. That meant four times and three to four more times in 2019. So what they did, they backtracked. So they're giving more monetary methadone to keep this phony government, the phony equity markets around the world pumped up. And now we just heard from China. China's dumping in more money into the banking system. China is coming out with terrible numbers. They had their worst year of car sales since the 1990s.
That's right.
There was a first decline, 15-year low in retail sales. The housing market is starting to unravel. They're dumping more money into it. As long as they keep dumping money into the system, it'll keep propping it up. The value of the U.S. dollar since the Federal Reserve was created in 1913 has devalued by 97%. So they don't care about the working people. They only care about pumping up the phony equity markets. And that's what's preventing it from crashing. We saw the crash was going on in December, November. Again, on December, in our trend alert, you get them. And the Trends Journal now is a monthly. In our trend alert on September 19th, 2018, we warned of an economic 9/11. And that was because the Federal Reserve said that, and this is 2 days before the markets peaked in the Dow and the S&P 500. And then after that, they went into their decline. We said it because of aggressive interest rate policy. The only thing that pumped up the markets after the panic of 08 was $250 trillion debt bubble that the central banks have pumped into the markets. So just like any junkie, they'll keep feeding it monetary methadone until some point the junkie ODs. When that will happen is when they stop giving it more monetary heroin.
You've been right all along. It's an I think it's an inevitability. It doesn't matter last year, this year, 2020. Of course, it's coming. Gerald, thanks for coming back today. Folks, go to OccupyPeace.com, go to TrendsResearch.com and subscribe to the journal if you haven't before. It really is terrific. It's accurate. It's helpful. Mate, it's been a boon to me for years in terms of giving me talking points and subject matter for this programme and also alerting me to various men and women that I've brought on the programme. It's a fantastic publication. Godspeed to you and to everybody who works with you. And in 5 or 6 weeks' time, I'll ask you to come back on again because I do like having you on a lot. You know that. So I don't want to leave it too long.
Quickly.
Yeah.
The United States, Brazil, and Argentina and Colombia are forming a triangle of death to attack Venezuela to overthrow the government. Watch that closely.
That's a huge story as well. Gerald, thanks for coming on today. Have a great rest of your day there. And I look forward to speaking again real soon.
Thank you.
Cheers for that. The brilliant Gerald Celente, live from New York today. It's approaching 2.5 minutes to the top of the hour. It's your Richie Allen Show live on Fab Radio 2 here in Manchester. Trigger warning, we're on TuneIn Radio, of course, as well, and everywhere else. Loads of tweets came in during that. To see what other people are tweeting me, just go to twitter.com and put @RichieAllenShow into Twitter, @RichieAllenShow into Twitter. I say hi to a few people who are tweeting. Hi to Busy there. Hi to Delroy. How you doing, Delroy? Hi to Martin in Spain. To JP in Manchester. Mentioned Patricia already. Faisal is tweeting away there as well. David at Of Argyle is tweeting as well as Patrick. Lots of stuff going on there. Interact with people while the programme is going on twitter.com just by putting Richie Allen Show, all one word, into Twitter. So in a couple of minutes' time, David Sedgwick is going to join us. He's got I won't say a brand new book. It came out back, I think, in November. And it's about the BBC. It's got a terrific title. It's called BBC Brainwashing Britain? And in the book, David looks at the methodology, the way in which the BBC deceives people, plants ideas in people's minds, shapes the agenda, mind controls people. This is fascinating stuff. You can read more about David at his website, davidsedgwick.co.uk. That's davidsedgwick.co.uk. He's going to join the show in a few minutes' time. I just want to follow up because I didn't script the earlier rant about the cognitive dissonance, about people's inability to exist alongside others who think differently to them, as was beautifully demonstrated by the messages left on YouTube overnight, which I wouldn't have seen because I don't read them. I don't have anything to do with it. But my mate Rog, who has a Facebook account as well, which I've got access to, but I don't use it very often. He looks after the Facebook page now because I came off Facebook, but he also looks after the YouTube channel. And he sent me these comments about my conversation with Jim Fetzer. And it is really frustrating to have to keep repeating yourself by repeatedly putting to Jim that in the cold light of day, Lenny Posner's interviews sounded authentic to me, and I felt that there was real pain in there. I wasn't saying that Lenny Posner is telling the truth. I don't know what the truth is. When are people going to grow up? And when you say, well, I don't know, that people can live with that. By saying I don't know, or that I'm not sure. But thanks, Jim. You've asked over the years with Wolfgang Halbig a lot of very serious questions that must be answered about Sandy Hook Elementary School. But I just listen to these parents and I'm not entirely convinced they're lying. Why can't people live with that? Why does that then become your part of the cover-up? It's intellectually redundant. It's intellectually retardant. You're not growing. You are regressing as a person. You are cocooning yourself into your internet world where all you seek out is those who agree with everything you say. It's terribly unhealthy. It's a dreadful thing. It's an illness, in fact. And you end up spending all your days in whataboutery. Whataboutery, whataboutery. I don't know what happened. It's like I don't know what happened on September the 11th. You're a shill then. You must be a shill. No. The official story is one of the greatest, most laughable bits of fiction ever offered to the people of the world. It's a nonsense. Complete nonsense. What really happened? I don't know. I wasn't there. You must know what happened in Sandy Hook, Richie. Funnily enough, I was living in Spain at the time. Would you believe it? I was living on the Costa del Sol. Like everybody else in Spain, I got the news late that night that something had happened in Connecticut. So no, I don't know what happened because I wasn't there. Should be good enough for people. The platform is created for people who do think they know what happened. But they can't just come on and say this happened and that happened without a credible presenter saying, well, hang on a second, what about this? This person disagrees with you, what about that? You have to live with that. Or don't listen to programs like this. What I'm going to say is going to sound very arrogant. There's a reason why this program is downloaded nearly 100,000 times a week on Podomatic. Check it out if you don't believe me. All the stats are there for everyone to see. There's a reason why it gets 300,000 views on YouTube. There's a reason why 60,000 people are listening to it right now. Because it's a professional program presented by a real journalist. Not a truth or industrial complex sign up. Not a fake truth or hoaxster who's after your money and knows how to get it just by telling you what you want to hear all day long. You need to exercise the grey matter between your ears. Get off the internet. Some of the time. Don't be horrified by meeting people who think differently than you do. I'm not going to say it again. I am going to say it again, and I'm going to say it for the final time. I haven't endorsed Lenny Posner. I said, I don't know. Guy called Robert came out of a building and was laughing and joking and then pretended to cry. I said that to Jim last night. It looked pretty suspicious to me. I don't know. We got to admit that. More often, we got to admit we don't know. Don't know. You're certain about Hampstead? I am, because I know that nothing happened in Hampstead. I know it, because the facts are very simple and very obvious when laid out about Hampstead. And the people who foisted that hoax on their tiny audience knew it was a hoax when they were doing it. But again, I'm not saying that satanic ritual abuse doesn't exist, because I've interviewed victims of it for many years, going back to the late 2000s in Spain. Some of them I found highly credible people. And as I said earlier on, if you want to learn about satanic ritual abuse, take any of the books published by David Icke in the late 90s, early 2000s, when he dealt with it in great detail, in a journalistic way. Don't believe the truthers. Truthers only interested in your money. And don't be an easy mark for them. All right? Very, very... That moves me, that. It's very important for me. You know I don't go on like this very often. Here's Kim Wilde, back with more in a minute. Kim Wilde on the Richie Allen Show, 6.5 minutes past the hour, Tuesday, January. It's Wednesday, even. Wednesday. All I had to do was look at the calendar right next to me. It's a Wednesday, January 16th, 2019. Great to be with you. A number of listeners contacted me over the holidays and even last week and said they'd read a book and they were thrilled by the book, in particularly in the times we live in. He said, Richie, you've got to get a copy of this book and you've got to invite the author of the book on. So I did just that. And thankfully, he agreed to come on the programme. The book is about the National Broadcaster, the British Broadcasting Corporation, the BBC. We've grown up with it, haven't we? We were told, I was told when I was studying English many years ago at third level, and then when I studied television and radio, the BBC is the bastion of decent, honest, objective journalism. Is it really, though? I've come to change my tune a little bit in recent years. My guest this hour is an academic and author, and he's written this book that asks very serious questions about the methodology of the BBC. The book is called BBC Brainwashing Britain. It's been described as a must read, and I'm delighted the author, David Sedgwick, joins me live on the line today. David, welcome back. How are you?
Oh, hi, Richie. Thanks. I'm fine, thanks. And hi to all the listeners, and thanks for having me on the show.
It's great to be here. It's great to have. I don't know why I said welcome back. It must be force of habit. This is your debut, well, of course, on the Richie Allen Show. So I apologise for that.
Well, I have got a feeling of déjà vu. I do these radio things quite a lot. So for a split second, I thought, maybe we have.
Well, do you know what? There is a connection. You spent a lot of time on the Costa del Sol, so did I. And yes. I know you did an interview, I think, with Bill Padley on Talk Radio Europe.
Oh, Talk Radio Europe, yes, indeed. Yes.
And I know Bill very well. I used to work for TRE when I lived in Spain many years ago.
So there is
a connection. Right, tell me.
We have got a connection.
We have a connection. You're an academic, you're a serious man. Masters in linguistics, I believe.
Yes, indeed. I've worked at British universities and abroad for the past 15, 16 years.
Now tell me about the BBC. When
I'm not boring. I want to add that I'm not a boring person, though.
There's nothing remotely boring about you. Now tell me about the BBC. When did you start to look at the BBC? You see, I did mention in the intro we were brought up with, you could always trust it, the greatest standards of decency and ethics. When did you start to think, well, hang on a second, all isn't right with the BBC?
Well, I've had suspicions for many years. I mean, people like me that I also do some lecturing in media studies over the years. So people like myself, we've had suspicions for many years. But I think, really, I think for myself and certainly a lot of people I speak to, it's really crystallized since 2016. And there were those two major upsets, let's call them, although I think that's a media thing about upsets, about the election of Donald Trump and the Brexit vote. And I think people looked at the BBC and thought, my God, what's going on with this organization? We're getting one-way propaganda virtually 24 hours a day. So if I had to date it, I would say 2016 for a lot of people. For myself, I've had my suspicions for many, many years, and I think people like me have, especially people who work, you know, in academia and broad, you know, in the study the media like I do, and I lecture on the media as well as linguistics.
So back around 2016, the upset in June 2016, the Brexit referendum, I voted to leave. So it was the first time in nearly 20 years that I'd voted in any referendum or election. And at the time, I can't argue with you. I'd love to argue with you for the sake of making it a better conversation. But you're right, the slant in the editorial right across the BBC programming was certainly pro-European, pro-Remain. But what was very interesting, and I think you've gotten into this in the book, the BBC is very clever. It's not just the political news breakfast shows or mid-morning shows. It gets into the sports programmes, doesn't it? And all sorts of stuff.
Well, indeed. I mean, just look at Gary Lineker, for example. I mean, he's rabid. And don't forget, you know, he's a representative of the BBC. And by their own guidelines, the last thing he should be doing is going on social media. Don't forget, he's got something like 10 or 11 million followers to his Twitter feed. And that's largely based on his presence as a BBC. See, what they do, they're quite clever. So Gary Lineker, if he wasn't a famous footballer working for the BBC, he wouldn't have 11 million followers. So what they do, they can get 11 million followers on Twitter, and then they can use that platform, like he is doing, to give us propaganda, you know, which is basically pro-EU propaganda. And he's not the only one. And like you rightly say, if you watch some of those BBC shows, I should also declare that I don't watch the BBC anymore, and I haven't done for 3 years. I get a lot of my information from other people, so I don't actually watch it anymore, but I'm aware of what's going on, and I'm aware that on their general television programs, dramas, serials, The Archers, Doctor Who, you name it, it's there. It's interlaced in everything they do now. In fact, the word I'm not sure if I use this word in the book, but I'd say it's saturated. It is politically saturated now. And sometimes it's quite implicit, although it's getting even explicit now, I think. But generally it's explicit. And sometimes the more bolder they become, the more audacious they become, the sort of the I don't know, you might call it a left-wing or social justice or whatever you want to call it, but that those politics are now clearly in most of its content, and I think it's reaching saturation points, and I think that's a dangerous place for the country to be going.
It's very dangerous. Are they breaching their own guidelines? I covered a story last year. I found it hilarious. I think you've got to go at some of these things with humour to try and to get people to look at them a second time. Mm. But one of their main... In fact, it was a gentleman working at the BBC whose job is in diversity. It's his job to make sure that there's a diversity of the BBC workforce. Mm. And he bizarrely gave an interview to one of the broadsheets, and I couldn't believe nobody picked up on it. He said in the interview, well, we're doing okay, but we need more lesbians. Now, I fell off my chair when I read it, David. I couldn't believe it. And I thought, look, I presume you're like me. We don't care whether people are gay, lesbian, straight, bisexual. It doesn't really matter.
And also, Richie, the majority of people don't.
No, they don't care. But I thought, why is he saying that? And are they in breach? I mean, surely they're in breach of employment law. But what about their own... What about the regulations governing the BBC? Surely there's something wrong with that, and we could talk about that with respect to how they covered and how they still cover the fallout from Brexit. Aren't they supposed to be held to account to ensure that their own opinions are kept out of it and that they try and strive for balance?
Well, as you quite rightly say, Richie, they should be. There's something called the Royal Charter. The Royal Charter is a document that explicitly sets out their obligations as a national broadcaster. And the idea is that if you follow what the Royal Charter says, then you can take approximately £5 billion per year from the British public and call yourself a national broadcaster. But because you're a national broadcaster, you can't be political. Because why? Because there's 25 million households in the United Kingdom paying for your license. And guess what? They all have different political opinions. They all have different world views. So the BBC has to sign this charter to say, OK, therefore, we promise to abide by the rules of impartiality. We will be fair. We will not support one side against another. We will present fairly and objectively. And of course, as my book points out, they break that charter every single day. And the reason they do it, Richie, is because the British government and Ofcom and people like that simply allow them to do it. Because effectively, what you've got a state broadcaster, which is in fact just a propaganda arm of the government. And the government are never going to stop them. I mean, look at the recent Brexit stuff. The government, any neutral government would have stepped in and said, sorry, this is terrible. You can't broadcast just this bias against Brexit. You can't do it. It's not fair. Your charter explicitly tells you that you can't do that. But have the government said a word? Virtually nothing. Because
no,
why? Because they're giving their own view.
Yeah, it's a Remainer Parliament. David Sedgwick is our guest this hour. David can stay on as long as he wants this hour. There's loads to talk about. And it's davidsedgwick.co.uk. His most recent book, it's very new, BBC Brainwashing Britain? Is it the most important book ever written about the BBC? I think it's a very important book, and I recommend you get it. Let's support the independent media. This is really important stuff here. Was it ever thus, then? Have guys like me been naive? It wielded an enormous power pre the internet days. It was the place where probably three, I'm making these stats up now, I have to say this, but maybe three in four people got their news from the BBC. Were they always aware of it? And have they always been trying to shape the population, to kind of mould us into a certain type of person?
Yeah, you're right there, Richie. I mean, even when it started in the early 20s, there was the idea. John Lord Reith, the first Director General, he explicitly laid out what the BBC was. The purpose of the BBC was to educate and inform. So they've always had that ideal, that sort of utopian ideal, that we are going to help the nation to understand the world and itself. That's fine. That's fine in itself, as long as you're covering all types of points of view. But I in the book, and I think I'm not the only person who has identified this, but from the 1960s onwards, I don't know if you can hear me all right over there.
I'm hearing you. There's just a tiny bit of interference on the line, but I can hear you, yeah.
Yeah. So since the 1960s, I think the BBC has become, and the word I use in the book is radical. There's a big gap at the moment in the market for a truly neutral source of news, because, you know, we've got the left, we've got the Guardian, you've got the Independent, you've got Channel 4 on that side, and you've got the right, Daily Mail, Breitbart, RT and Fox on the other side. Now, the BBC should be occupying the middle ground between those two opposing views, but it doesn't. It's thrown its lot in with the Guardian, the Independent and BuzzFeed. And that's what it is, essentially. It's the sort of, people call it the Guardian of the airwaves, whereas really it should be in the middle ground, and it should be holding the left to account and the right to account, but it doesn't.
No,
absolutely.
There's loads of tweets on this, David, by the way. Huge interest in this. Rich Mortimer tweets, listening to David constantly saying, the BBC constantly saying, crashing out of Europe and on a collision course. Yeah. This really gets on my nerves, Richie. It's never said that we may be entrenched in a corrupt dictatorship, is it? That's a great point. At no point, we get that nonstop. It's terrible. Yeah. Crashing out. We can't crash out.
It's a very good point, Richie. And notice also the other thing that the BBC have studiously avoided describing what a World Trade Organization withdrawal looks like.
Yeah.
You don't know anything about, if sitting and watching your television, you know nothing about the World Trade Organization. It could be something from a James Bond movie run by Goldfinger.
Right.
We know nothing about it. We don't know about the mechanisms, and there's a purpose why the BBC has purposely decided not to tell us anything about the World Trade Organization. They want to keep it shrouded in mystery, and they've done that purposely and willfully to push this nonsense about crashing over cliffs. Incredible. And actually, if you think about it, it just shows you the BBC mindset. They actually think, rightly or wrongly, that they can pull the wool over people's... We're in 2019. We're in the age of multiple sources of information, the internet. But the BBC acts like it's the 1950s. It really thinks that if they don't tell us about the World Trade Organization, we can't find anything out about it.
Absolutely. It is extraordinary. And, you know, I do a news roundup for the first 20 minutes of this program. It contains audio clips from the BBC and Sky and ITV every day. And I listen to it fastidiously every morning so that I have material for the live program. And you are right. At no time have they brought somebody on from academia who is pro a WTO exit, who can explain that. Well, funnily enough, we trade with every other country in the world outside Europe on WTO terms, and it doesn't do us any harm at all. It can be managed. They absolutely avoid that like the plague. It's got to be biased, David.
And
you must
will,
be right.
That will be an edict from above, because don't forget all those journalists working at the BBC. One of the things I really object to, one thing that worries me and should worry everybody, is that what you have about 20,000 employees at the BBC. And what you have those 20,000 people are pumping out the propaganda which is given to them from above. So you're talking probably about a couple of dozen executives, the director general, the BBC board of governors, and the chairman. What their political opinions are filtered down to these 20,000 activists, the Gary Linekers, the Graham Nortons, the BBC newsreaders, and those people are effectively giving the British public the political opinion and the world view of a very tiny minority of BBC executives. It's turned into basically a political channel for, well, a very tiny minority of very powerful BBC executives.
For the establishment.
You call them the establishment, yes, the pro-EU, liberal, metropolitan establishment. They are the people who run the BBC. People are getting the opinions and the worldview of that very, very small, tiny minority of people, and they're trying to make it look as if this is the majority of the British people. And it's not. We're sitting at home, listening to our radios and watching our TVs, absolutely shrieking. We're saying, who's running this thing? Why are they giving me this rubbish?
Absolutely.
Who's
right.
Who's running this thing?
David Sedgwick is our guest. It's davidsedgwick.co.uk. We'll tweet a link out with massive interest. Loads of tweets on this. It's at Richie Allen Show on Twitter. If you have a comment for David, just leave your comment and just tag in at Richie Allen Show and I will see it. Number of people are tweeting, and this is incredible, because I've had academics on the programme, like Stuart Waiton from Abertay University in Dundee, I think it is, and others. And one of the things that people are concerned that the BBC is doing is that it's re-educating people in a very negative way. It's trying to kind of confer upon people that there are certain things that you are not allowed to think, let alone say. Because if you do, you're a pariah. You know, you can't have opinions about same-sex marriage. You can't have opinions about same-sex adoption and all that sort of stuff. Now, I don't particularly have any opinions on any of those issues myself, but the BBC seems to be front and centre in an agenda to kind of homogenise the world, that you must think this way about everything, and if you don't, you're a bigot. Have you sympathy with that point of view, David?
Oh, well, I think really that's one of the raison d'etre of the current BBC, and it's one of the huge problems. But what they do, it's quite insidious, really, Richie, because what they do is, you're right, they are trying to steer, and they'd use that word steer because we know what we're doing and you don't know what you're doing. So we're going to steer you into this particular worldview, which I would call a sort of pro-green, soft left, liberal, pro-environmental issues, that sort of area. They're trying to steer people into that territory. Now, like you said, if you don't agree with the BBC, they've got all sorts of ways of making you agree. And one of them, which I think I mentioned in the book, is to name and shame people. So look at the way they treat, for example, someone like Jacob Rees-Mogg.
Yes.
And he's always the butt of BBC jokes. If you watch those panel shows, Jacob Rees-Mogg, Boris Johnson, in fact, anyone who happens to be male, conservative, white, particularly white, and they're not very, very happy with white males, particularly people who are conservative, who support Brexit, you'll be the butt of BBC joke, satire and humour. And I think, take Nigel Farage, for example. And that's how they control the public forum, because if you get on the wrong side of them, they will have you up in the BBC stocks. And that means that people will be hurling insults, jokes, satire at you. And that's how they control it. It's a very subtle way of controlling what people think and say. You don't want to get on the wrong side of the BBC, especially if you are a politician, Richie. And that is dangerous.
You know, when reading this and thinking about it, a part of me wanted to disagree with you. And a part of me wanted to say, well, look, we've got to be big and ugly enough to take the jokes and to take the satire and laugh at it. But because I'm not, you know, because I'm not entrenched in my thinking, I began to think about what you were saying. And I thought, Jesus, David is absolutely right here. What they're doing is they're creating a narrative. They're kind of implanting in people an idea that these guys are just they're just buffoons, they're idiots, they're morons. They're like relics to be dusted down every now and then, but what they're saying isn't really important, so don't pay attention to them. I think you've got that spot on, I think.
Richie, I mean, you're right. I mean, I think I said in the book that I think politicians should be subject to criticism. That's fine. I think that's great. But it only goes one way with the BBC. I mean, you will never find people satirizing Diane Abbott or Dawn Butler. They are left-wing, Labour, black females. Well, you could have a whole programme on Dawn Abbott. We know, Diane Abbott. She's made some terrible gaffes.
Yeah.
Where's the BBC? Well, how come she's not lambasted constantly? Oh, no. She's off limits. And I also mentioned in the book the disgraceful episode when they gave a free pass to a certain Labour MP who retweeted that very, very infamous tweet about white girls should shut their mouths up, the victims of Rotherham should shut their mouths up. And the Labour MP retweeted and liked that, and the BBC never mentioned it. So the problem is that certain politicians, certain celebrities, if you agree with the BBC worldview, Gary Lineker, Graham Norton, Diane Abbott, anyone who's basically seems to be on the left and is also pro-EU, you can do anything. You can call names, you can attack people, you can shout, scream, you can write horrible articles, and the BBC will simply let you have a free pass. However, if they happen to disagree with your worldview, if you're a Nigel Farage or a Donald Trump, heaven help you, if you do something or say something wrong, you'll be on the front page of the BBC for weeks. It's completely lopsided.
In the absence of anybody from the BBC, again, not just to play the devil's advocate, but if there was a BBC producer here, he or she might say, well, hang on a second now, lads. 'Tis obvious where you were coming from, independent media and an independent author. It's obvious where you're coming from. You're coming at this with, you know, bias of your own. They might say, listen, we always have Farage on. He's on all the time. We often have Rees-Mogg on Breakfast in the Morning. In fact, he was on a couple of times this week with Nicky Campbell. They will say, give over. Have I got news for you? Might be taking the mickey out of his plummy accent and all of that, but he's on our programmes all the time. He gets equal opportunity. That's what they would say.
They would say that. And, of course, what I would say to that is, look at the way you treat someone like Nigel Farage and look at the way you treat Jacob Rees-Mogg, and just look at the amount of interruptions, the hostile style of interviewing. Look at the studio audiences who are, let's just be honest about this, they are hand-picked. So whenever you get, let's say they put Nigel Farage on a show, you can guarantee that he will, first of all, he'll be up against 2, 3, or 4 people who are arguing against him. Imagine Question Time panel, for example. And you'll also have a specially selected audience, which is usually selected because of they hold the political opinions the opposite to Nigel Farage. So what you get poor old Jacob Rees-Mogg or Nigel Farage, who I think are thoroughly decent people, and they will be subject to what I call the BBC crucible. And they're put in this crucible, and I compare it to the medieval stocks. And I think people who are put in medieval stocks, yes, you can see them, but when you're getting vegetables and rotten fruit and vegetables thrown at you, it's not quite what I would call promotion. And that's what I say to the BBC.
Let me argue with you. Let me argue with you, David. By the way, I'm loving this. I'm loving having you
Please
on,
do.
By the way. Thanks for coming on. David Sedgwick is our guest. DavidSedgwick.co.uk. Do buy his book. Got to support the independent media. Not just for the sake of it. The book is really, really good. And it's very thought-provoking. So get it. BBC Brainwashing Britain. DavidSedgwick.co.uk. Let me argue with you.
Yeah.
I'll argue with you now and say, well, doesn't that backfire on the BBC? Because these lefty type journalists, politicians who are given the softball treatment all the time, they end up becoming, they become kind of like empty vessels. They're not very good. Whereas Farage and Johnson and Jacob Rees-Mogg, it actually makes them better orators. And in fact, they actually ultimately do better because they become better at dealing with that sort of examination, as opposed to the Diane Abbotts and the others who kind of get an easy ride.
It's an interesting observation that, Rich. Yeah, I think paradoxically it probably might backfire on them, but I don't think that's going to change the BBC anytime soon. I think they have one way of working, and it's attack, attack, attack. I mean, you only have to look at the Donald Trump stuff to see that they can never change their ways. And that's an interesting point, that yes, I'm sure that it makes Jacob Rees-Mogg and Nigel Farage even better at debating. And actually, maybe, possibly, it makes people because they become more persuasive and they can back up their arguments, and they have to take on two or three opposition people on these, invariably on these BBC panel shows, that actually makes them stronger in their opinions and more articulate. And yes, you're probably right, and that probably might actually help people to vote for Brexit or to vote for the Tories or to vote for UKIP or whoever, you know, is in the spotlight there. So yeah, you're probably right about that, but I don't give the BBC enough credence for them to be actually able to understand that, to be honest with you.
No, fair enough, David. Loads to get into, and there are loads of tweets. Let me just read a couple of tweets there.
Yeah.
Faisal tweets, I wouldn't say that they don't lampoon the left. Corbyn, Ken Livingstone, George Galloway, etc., who are the non-corporate warmongering left, are lampooned all the time. That's a good comment, Faisal. I would say on Faisal's comment, I'm going to endorse what you said about Diane, because I remember going back a few years, Diane Abbott was regularly had the mickey taken out of her on Have I Got News For You. But I think at some stage, particularly when this Me Too story evolved and grew, I think probably you talked about the men in grey suits at the very top of the organisation might have said, well, if we, you know, leave Diane Abbott alone because we'll be open for accusations of misogyny and racism. I think you're absolutely right. Diane Abbott is kind of, you know, don't say anything about Diane Abbott on the comedy shows, but I think they used to. But Faisal says Corbyn, Livingstone, Galloway, they're often mocked on these particular programmes.
Yeah, I would agree to a certain point. I mean, obviously, we'd have to do some sort of content analysis to see the numbers there. I think what it is, I think if the BBC have a very centrist view of the world, and it's not just on the right, obviously, I think since the emergence of Jeremy Corbyn, they've been pretty harsh on Jeremy Corbyn, because remember, what the BBC are trying to do, they're trying to get the nation to think in a sort of soft left, centrist, liberal fashion. And to them, Jeremy Corbyn is an extremist on the left, as Nigel Farage might be on the right. And the idea is to paint the image or the association in the public's mind that Farage is an extremist and Corbyn is an extremist, although I happen to believe that Corbyn is an extremist more palatable to the BBC than Farage is. But yes, I think Faisal's quite right. Anyone who doesn't jump to the BBC tune, anyone who offers something other than this kind of what I would describe personally as a sort of soft, soppy liberalism, anyone is an enemy to the BBC. I say in the book that I think the BBC are effectively a globalist propaganda organization. So anyone who challenges the neoliberal order, the globalist corporatist neoliberal order, and you could argue that Jeremy Corbyn could do that just as much as Nigel Farage could, is potentially an enemy to the BBC, because, Richie, I think you have to understand that the BBC does not represent the people. It actually represents the globalist, corporatist, financial elite, as indeed the British government do, as we're seeing in Brexit.
I wish I could argue with you. I can't. You're right. I wish that Corbyn was the extremist on the left that he's portrayed to be. Because, you see, I'm an old socialist, David. I'm an unashamed, unapologetic old socialist. No, but of course, he's a left social democrat. And I think Nigel, and Nigel used to come on with me on Talk Radio Europe regularly, and I liked him. I liked him coming on. I think Nigel is more centrist than, again, the media portrays him. Let me read out two tweets, very good tweets. Yeah. Les tweets, BBC employees have to take a course called Unconscious Bias so the journalists know they're spouting propaganda. Andy tweets, spot on about the BBC. David, I saw the light during the referendum debate as to which side the BBC was taking. It is apparently EU-funded to a large extent. Where's the transparency? Not to mention the diversity agenda, which I know you get into, of course, in the book, which is a massive thing. Let me just put one point to you, David, before you come back in. It's not a point, it's more of an observation. One of the times in the last couple of years when I really kind of balked, when I was sitting watching a BBC show and I couldn't believe my eyes, was when Jeremy's brother, Piers Corbyn, was on The Big Questions with Nicky Campbell to talk about climate change. Now, whatever anybody thinks about climate change is irrelevant. Piers was there as a meteorologist, as a scientific man, to say that I can show how the data has been manipulated. Things are not as dire as they are made out to be. And I don't believe that man's industrial activity is warming the planet. That's what Piers was there to say. So they put these non-scientific people from Friends of the Earth on with Piers. Nicky Campbell was obnoxious. He wouldn't let Piers speak. And then, incredibly, and it illustrates everything you've written in your book, Campbell looked at a woman from Friends of the Earth, pointed at Piers and went, "See, this is what you have to put up with." I couldn't believe it, David. I'm a real journalist. I'm a real, you know, I worked in mainstream radio in Ireland for WLR. I worked in national radio. I thought I'd have been fired for doing that.
Well, you see, Richie, that's it. That's a good microcosm of how the BBC operates. Because as I note in the book, they approach every single subject you can possibly think of. And I'm thinking politics, social and cultural. They approach them with what I call the master narrative. The master narrative is the BBC line. And it doesn't matter what evidence you produce, the BBC are going to stick to that master narrative. So climate change is real, it is 100% proven, end of story. There was a BBC memo that went round quite recently saying, that's it, as far as the BBC is concerned, climate change is finished, the debate is over. And now every single one of those 20,000 BBC people, like Nicky Campbell, get the memo, they understand, and they know what they have to do. Anyone who tries to argue against that is mocked, outnumbered, satirized, interrupted, talked over, etc., etc. So Piers Corbyn, like you said, is a very respectable scientist.
Yeah, and nice guy too.
He got the treatment. And that's, you know, it's the same whether it's Jacob Rees-Mogg, whether it's Boris Johnson, whether it's Donald Trump, whether it's Islam, Christianity, Catholicism, geography, cosmology, you name it, the BBC have got a line. And the BBC are 100% correct. That's their weakness and their strength in a way, because it's actually supreme arrogance. And it's quite possibly that kind of arrogance that I think is currently undoing them. They will not see another point of view. To them, Donald Trump is Darth Vader, you know, on acid. And they're never going to change that view. And if Donald Trump were to find a cure for AIDS tomorrow, and cancer, and poverty, the BBC would hate him, because they're never going to change. And that's, like I said, it's a major, major weakness. And it's all what I call in the book the BBC narratives. And there's a BBC narrative for everything. Fracking. You know, health, education, school dinners. The BBC have got a view on everything.
Yeah.
And the other thing is...
Shines through.
It's totally uniform. It is 100% uniform in that organisation. You will not find any dissent. And that's why in the book I talk about the cult of the BBC. Because to me, it's a cult. It operates exactly like a cult does.
This is tremendous stuff. It's very important stuff, this. Gail is listening to this. She's bought the book. Well done, Gail. Good stuff. BBC Brainwashing Britain. The question, it's a question posed on the cover of the book. David Sedgwick, the author, is live on the line with me this hour. It's flying by. Thanks for the tweets. I'm going to read a couple more of them. Patrick, before we get to Patrick, Moinga says, Richie, David is very spot on here. Have I got news for you? Always takes the piss on Farage or Rees-Mogg, even when they are not on. It's like the jabs are part of Ian Hislop and Merton's contract to do it weekly. Very good. Patrick tweets, I must admit that I sometimes listen live to Nigel on LBC. He is a real politician and gets a bad press, leading to most ordinary people disliking him. Usually, he makes perfect sense and deserves more respect. So Patrick, without knowing it, although Patrick probably does know it, he's led to the next brilliant question. I agree with everything you've said. I shouldn't say that I'm supposed to be impartial, but my listeners know better because they listen to my monologues. So I'd be lying if I said I'm impartial. I'm not. I have a lot of sympathy with your arguments in your excellent book. But,
Richie, at least you're admitting that.
I admit it. Oh, yeah, up front, yeah.
One of the big problems with the BBC is it pretends it's playing this big game. We're saying, hey, we're impartial, folks. We're totally objective. We're totally neutral. And you sit there and you think, you are not. You are 100% not. Just come across and just say, look, guys, we hate Farage. We hate Brexit. We hate Trump. Our broadcasts are going to exhibit that bias. But, of course, the moment they did that, the government would have to pull the funding.
Yeah,
so they will never admit it.
Of course they won't admit it. So, Patrick's point, Nigel on LBC. Hmm. Brilliant point, because it leads to... I was going to ask you this anyway. With the rise of LBC, with the rise of talk radio, which is doing very well also, and the bizarre spectacle these days of politicians hosting their own radio shows, which I think is a terrible thing, but that's a conversation for another day. Though you are 100% right, I think, in what you're saying, does it matter anymore? Because there are these other outlets that have very big audiences, very big followings, that the Jacobs and Boris and the rest of them can get their point across.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, I think in the book I've noticed, I think I note that the BBC figures are pretty dire in terms of certainly in terms of retention of the license fee. I mean, it might shock people to realise that almost for the last 10, 11 years, we've had almost about 1 million television license fee cancellations per year. And this is not including the over 75s, of course, who get a free license. If you look at the figures for BBC television programmes, I think in my conclusion of my book, I've got a bit of research about that shows how the audience is tanking. They are losing figures, viewing figures, and they're also losing license fee subscriptions every single year. So you're right that they face immense competition. So that's very healthy. But looking at the wider picture, what kind of competition are they facing? Because yes, LBC, I know they sort of pay lip service to the right or to the pro Brexit by having Farage on and the rest of them, as far as I can gather. Certainly James O'Brien, one of my favourites, seem to follow the sort of LBC mainstream media BBC line themselves. I mean,
that's right.
Flick over from BBC One to ITV to Channel 4 to Sky, and you get pretty much the same BBC neoliberal, in brackets Marxist, I would call it, mainstream media neoliberalism. So yes, that's a good thing. But you know, paying lip service to someone like Farage and giving his own show once a week, okay, that's a step in the right direction. But you know, you still feel that they're all swimming against the tide. But that's not necessarily a BBC thing. That's a problem for the media. The media is. The BBC and the media are one and the same thing. They share exactly the same opinion. So yes, the BBC might be shrinking. Its competitors are getting a little bit larger, but by and by they sort of seem to share the same sort of metropolitan neoliberal politics. So I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing. I think it's a bad thing personally.
It is a bad thing. Number of tweets, because time is flying by. It's 17 and a half minutes to the top of the hour already. Number of tweets saying that it's great that you're focusing on this, but Richie, you should be asking about the drama and entertainment. Well, David's already been talking about the entertainment programmes, but people are talking about programmes like EastEnders, another massive show over the last 30 odd years, millions of viewers, and how the storylines in that programme are selling this liberal agenda that you've been talking about, shaping people's thinking, and that it's deliberate and that it's not as subtle as maybe it should, not as subtle as maybe you think it is. Good point, that through EastEnders and stuff.
It's very true, Richie. Don't forget, anybody, you're not going to get a script through the BBC unless you've got the narratives in there. And that's my point in the book. Everything they do is based on these narratives. If you write a script and you have a positive comment, say, for example, about Donald Trump, then I don't know whether you're going to get that script through the BBC. It's
you
going
might
to be
not.
Sanitized, or it's going to be changed, or your career is over. I think I made that point in the book about it. Look
you
at
have
David
made
Bellamy,
that, yeah.
Robert Kilroy Silk. They decided to give an opinion that wasn't BBC, and they lost their careers. I mean, the BBC is an enormously powerful organisation. And the kind of control it exerts, it doesn't even need to write that control down. It doesn't need to say it. It's assumed. If you come up with a wrong opinion at the BBC, the wrong political opinion, then you'd better be careful, because you probably won't have a career left. And everybody who works that organisation and everybody in the media is aware of that. It's not just BBC people. People in the media realise they have to have the right opinions. And that's part of what I link in my book to the Ministry of Truth in George Orwell's 1984, because that's a book about massive psychological groupthink, where all the people who work for the party know what the right opinion is, and they must have the right opinion. And that's what I think the BBC is right now. That's dangerous.
Is it doing that to the population? Because with everybody moving on to Twitter and Facebook, we've been corralled by these two giant companies. Everybody is in the same place. So is that methodology resulting in people beginning to self-censor? You know, through the programming of the BBC and elsewhere, I must think this and I must say this, because if I don't, I could be in trouble. I could be kicked out of the herd.
Well, this is it. I mean, don't forget, Richie, what we've got a sort of a political entertainment, those people in the spheres, in the public consciousness, actors, singers, politicians, TV presenters, yeah, I would argue that they're all under the same pressure to conform. I mean, have you ever seen a TV presenter, a pop singer, an actor saying, yes, I'm pro-Brexit? There's not many, are there? What about pro-Trump? If you do that in America, you've had it. You're finished. You're never going to work again if you dare to say, I voted for Donald Trump. Apart from the fact you might get beaten up or your car might get trashed, you're certainly, if you're a celebrity or if you're in the public eye, you're going to get a lot of flack. I mean, look at Katie Hopkins, look at people like that, Nilo Yiannopoulos, look at the flack they get. And all they're doing is expressing an opinion. That's the opposite.
They do love it, though, and they dine out on it.
Oh, yeah.
And they become very wealthy, don't they? Let's be honest about it.
Well, it's true, they do. I mean, they do exploit that, and good luck to them. But for ordinary people, though, let's face it, Richie, for ordinary people, I'm an academic. I work at university. I can tell you, I would not dare to tell people at my university that I'm a pro-Trump supporter, or at least his policies, should I say, and I'm a Brexit supporter. I wouldn't dare, because every single one in my staff room, I can tell you, I would be sent to Coventry. Or even worse places, maybe Birmingham. I don't know. I'd be ostracised.
We have some Brummy listeners. You're in trouble now, my son. I know you're only joking. Of course, you're joking. My audience got very thick-skinned.
Can I joke? I mean, you see, that's the other thing.
Exactly. Can you joke anymore? It's ridiculous, isn't it? You can't say anything without somebody saying, I am offended. Or
I happen to think Birmingham's a very nice place, actually. So.
Listen, do you know, you're touching on something important. What we have now, and the BBC are brilliant at doing this, is people taking offence on behalf of other people. It's bad enough taking offence yourself. I mean, I'm a guy with a strong Irish accent. It's been pointed out to me many times over the years. I've often been asked about my drinking. It's been said to me many times over the years. I just laugh, you know. It's funny. Yeah, yeah. It's not offensive. And if it would be a personal choice to take offence. That was bad enough. Now we have people looking to take offence on behalf of other people. It's ridiculous. And the BBC is right in the middle of that.
The BBC is a chief promoter of that, and you know, as I mentioned in the book, sorry, about this idea of cultural Marxism, this idea that there is a sort of force out there which is gradually trying to usurp Western tradition, Western culture, and it's out there and it's burrowing underneath us as we speak, and we are sort of allowing it by, like you said, self-censoring, being quiet. There are only certain things now we can say in our living rooms. We've got to be very careful. If you've got one of those Alexa things, maybe you can't even say it in your living room anymore. Who knows what Amazon are doing with that? You're right. This is happening to us. And the BBC, as I point out in the book, I think are the chief drivers of it. Although their power is on the wane, that's for sure. But don't forget, they started at such a high bar that even now in 2019, they are still easily the UK and one of the world's biggest broadcasters, although, you know, that power is decreasing year on year on year. But in the early 1980s, they had a 50% share of the UK broadcast sector.
Yeah.
Now they've got 24, 25%. That's still massive.
It's still massive, and you can't discount the influence they've had, because you touched on this earlier on in the print press. And also, LBC, maybe leave LBC to one side, but elsewhere they've had a huge influence, because there are, you know, there are hundreds of bastard sons of the BBC in terms of broadcasters in other organisations around the country. So they've shaped broadcasting as much. So even if it is only 25 or 30% now, you know, it's still kind of overarching in terms of they've shaped the landscape for how producers work and how presenters work. So I think you make a brilliant point there. It's coming up for 11:30. We've got about 3-4 minutes left on this. I better give another plug to the book. Go to davidsedgwick.co.uk. The book is on Amazon. It's a BBC Brainwashing Britain ? Very timely, this. It really is. You know, think long and hard about what David has been talking about here, how it influences you, how it influences people. Just before, I'm going to give you the final word in a second, but I want to talk just for a second about something you're touching on there. I was in London in 2013 doing a TV thing, and I was staying very near the studio, which was in North Wembley. and Brent. And Brent is fairly depressed as a place. It's not got very nice buildings. Loads of lovely people. I'm not being politically correct in saying that. Nice people, nice place, but horrible architecture. They built a stadium, £800 million, Wembley. They did nothing for the surrounding area. It's a tough place architecturally and all of that. I sound like I'm up my own arse now by saying architecturally. But anyway, met a gentleman one day. He was in his 70s. And I was in the company of a friend of mine who was also working at the TV station that we were involved in. We met this lovely old man, and he'd been watching some of the programmes we were making. And he got very tearful. And I said, "What's up with you? Why are you crying?" And he said, "It's great to be able to watch people who don't call me racist, because I'm concerned about the fact that I can't get an appointment at my local NHS clinic. I can't get to see a dentist because there are so many people recently come into the area, whether it's from Eastern Europe or whether it's from African countries or whatever. I don't have a racist bone in my body," he said. "Everybody, we're all God's creatures. I have nothing against anybody. But things are tough. Why did they keep letting more and more people in?" And he was in tears because he said, "I'm told..." He didn't say the BBC specifically, but he said, "I'm told every time I turn the television on that I'm a racist." And the BBC is genius at doing that.
Yes. Yeah, and because what it's done very craftily and what it continues to do is to basically deliberately polarise is a very, very complex issue. Immigration, in the BBC's eyes, there are two possible strands to the argument. One of them is, you either agree with the BBC, which is open borders, mass migration, constant influx of new people coming into towns and cities, constantly changing the face of communities that have been, you know, pretty solid and stable for hundreds of years in some cases, and often working class communities. I'm sure your gentleman you were talking to has noticed that. At the other end of the spectrum, if you disagree with it, they instantly will label you, as that gentleman, as some sort of neo-Nazi, racist, I don't know, whatever, Islamophobe,
Neanderthal, etc. Yeah.
Completely ignoring the massive middle ground, which is, there's a whole difference, there's a whole area in that middle, which is, you might not want mass migration, but you might not want complete no migration. They are two extremes, and what the BBC tries to do, it tries to just talk about those two extremes. Either you agree with us, the BBC, and we have completely, you know, hundreds of millions of people going around the world, mass migration. If you don't, you're racist. And that's what they try and do. And they deliberately try to polarize and simplify that argument, whereas we know there's a massive amount of opinion in the middle about different kinds of cultures, different kinds of people, professional migration, student migration, temporary migration, permanent migration. And at the end of the day, a lot of that has very little to do with skin color and has a lot to do with practical situations, cultural appreciation. It has a lot of to do with that, and financial worries, services, etc. It depends on the area you're in, what kind of area you live in, urban, rural. People in London don't seem to mind. That's great. People in other communities that are more solid and stable, they do mind. It disturbs them a little bit. That's fair enough. But the BBC polarizes it, totally polarizes the debate into either you agree with the BBC, which is the neoliberal agenda that we have, driven by the globalist, global corporatist, cheap labour, or you are a total racist and you're going to be a pariah and we're going to name and shame you, especially if you're a celebrity, and we will finish your career if you dare. So people keep these thoughts to themselves, like the gentleman you're talking about. And the BBC, unfortunately, has completely lost the plot and has gone into this, what I would call, is the Marxist polarisation, which is either you're with us or you're against us. And it's a disgrace that they've actually made the argument, that's oversimplified the argument to that extent.
You know, you're right, and not only is all of that spot on, but they refuse to report on Western countries, including this country, giving oxygen and life to jihadist terrorist groups in Syria and in Libya and elsewhere, often resulting in hundreds of thousands of people being displaced and then looking for refuge. We could be here all night long. We're just about out of time. I want to give a plug again. davidsedgwick.co.uk. BBC Brainwashing Britain is the book. Do me a favour, in the near future, come back on again. I've loved having you on, David.
Yes, I'd love to come on, Richie. Great speaking to you. I've enjoyed it.
It's been brilliant. A number of people have mentioned. I'll give you the final word. We've got about 60 seconds. You can have them. Because a number of people have said, listen, they've done unbelievable real life and natural life programs over the years. Attenborough, the Blue Planet. They've been such a force for good in so many other areas. Last word to you, David.
Absolutely agree. And I couldn't agree more with that. And what a great shame that they've decided to go in this direction, because at its best, the BBC could be a national treasure. I completely agree with that. And I, for one, was brought up with the BBC as a child, like you probably were as well, Richie. Yeah. And I, every day, I think, what a shame they've decided to take this turn.
Absolutely. Listen, come back on. I won't be able to speak to you off air because of the system here.
Yep.
I'm just going to lose you when we hang up. But I'll be in touch via email to invite you back on in a few weeks' time, because I've loved it. There's been a huge reaction to it. And thanks for your time. DavidSedgwick.co.uk, BBC Brainwashing Britain. Support the independent media. Read the book. And it was a pleasure, David.
Thank you, everybody. Bye.
Bye for now, my friend. Bye. David Sedgwick live on the Richie Allen Show. The time approaching 4.5 minutes to the top of the hour. Fascinating stuff. Thanks for those tweets, by the way. And thanks to those of you who made the point, a number of you made the point about the natural programmes, the nature-based, the documentary-based programmes that the BBC has made over the years. Of course, it's not all doom and gloom, but increasingly, in recent years, it has attempted to shape the people of the country, to mould the people into this cultural Marxist kind of outlook on the world, this neoliberalist, as David called it there, kind of approach, kind of identity. And it is doing that, and there's no better example of it than how the BBC has reported on the referendum of 2016, the result of that, and then what we've been left with now. Fascinating stuff, David Sedgwick. Interesting programme tonight. Thanks to Gerald Salente. Go to occupypeace.com. Do go to trendsresearch.com. Consider subscribing to the Trends Journal. I get it. I know I get a complimentary copy of it, but it is terrific. You also heard David Sedgwick, the author of BBC Brainwashing Britain. His website is davidsedgwick.co.uk. That's it for the show. Can't tell you an awful lot about tomorrow's programme yet because I don't have the diary to hand. I think I've got bookings. If I don't have bookings, I will make bookings, and we will speak again at 5 p.m. UK time tomorrow, okay? Final word to star Gypsy Girl, who said that she loves the show, but why are you being so bullish, she says, about Sandy Hook. I'm not. You have to understand that. I'm not saying that Jim Fetzer or Wolfgang Halbig are wrong at all. I'm not saying that at all. I'm saying, and I did say last night, that I personally found some of the testimony made by Lenny Posner to be fairly compelling. I'm not endorsing Lenny. And I want you to ask yourself a question, not just to Gypsy Stargirl, but to everybody else for whom it matters so much that I agree with you chapter and verse. Why does it matter to you so much? Why do you so much want me to say, yeah, the whole thing was a flat, nobody died, the whole thing was... Why do you want me to say that? Isn't it enough that I provide a platform for those who do believe that, and that I treat them with respect and professionalism? Isn't that my job? Shouldn't it not matter at all what I think? Just keep that in mind, right? All right. Speak tomorrow at 5, leaving you with Elton John and this song, Daniel. Love this. See you tomorrow. Bye now. Thanks for listening. Hope you'll be with me tomorrow. Until then, bye.